Jacob and Adam.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Let me introduce us and introduce people to this momentous occasion, because this is the first ever Blogging Heads that is not a dialogue. It involves more than two people. There's an actual moderator, and that would be me. And let me introduce you two. Jacob Sullum, you're from Reason Magazine, and you are not a fan of gun control, it is safe to say. Adam Winkler of UCLA Law School, right? You are a somewhat bigger fan of gun control, and you're the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And you guys have a little to argue about. Let's start maybe by establishing what you agree on. I think you know enough about each other's positions to have some sense for that. Just as far as interpreting the Second Amendment, okay, which I will now read. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Adam, what's your understanding about what you two agree on about the Second Amendment?
Well, I think both Jacob and I agree that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual's right to have guns for personal protection. When you read the Second Amendment, you left out one of the most interesting parts, which is the numerous commas that are sprinkled throughout the Second Amendment. It's almost as if James Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, had just discovered this wonderful new thing, the comma, and wanted to put it in there as many times as possible. And ever since he did so, the Second Amendment has proven confusing for generations of Americans. However, there has been a long tradition of interpreting the Second Amendment to protect an individual right to bear arms. And whether you believe in originalism, that we should interpret the Constitution solely by lights of the original intent of the framers, which seems to me clear, to protect an individual's right to have guns as part of the citizens' militia, or whether you believe in a living Constitution, the idea that the Constitution evolves to keep up with changes in society, I think either approach you take, you come up with the same conclusion, which is that the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to have their own personal firearms.
Okay, so let me see if I understand you. First, I need to apologize to people, and possibly to Jacob, I don't know, because this is my first time doing this. During the introduction, when I was speaking, it was actually Jacob's face that loomed largest because I failed to manipulate a control properly. So if that confused people, I'm sorry, and Jacob, if you're self-conscious, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But we will continue. I gather the agreement you have on the Second Amendment actually reflects what you would say has become a kind of consensus, which is to say that just because it says a well-regulated militia being necessary, blah, 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 that doesn't mean that people have to be in some sort of militia in order to have a right to bear arms.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Adam shows in his book is that the militia was the whole body of people, or at least males, who were able to bear arms, and they were expected to bring the weapons that they had at home with them when they were called to service. So in that sense, once you conceive of the militia as being essentially everybody, then you can understand how the need for a militia is consistent with the idea of the people, meaning all the individuals who comprise society, having a right to have weapons.
Okay. And is almost no one now making the argument I just alluded to, that it isn't even an individual right that's being described here?
I think some people still will make that argument that once you have the National Guard, that takes care of the militia, and therefore individuals no longer have a right on their own, or never had a right on their own, to have guns. But more commonly, what you'll hear from President Obama, for example, is that the Second Amendment does protect an individual right, but people may have a very wide concept of what regulations are reasonable under the Second Amendment. So, for example, President Obama actually said that both the D.C. gun law and the Chicago's gun laws, which are the two severest sets of gun laws in the country, which essentially made it impossible for people to defend themselves with guns in their homes, that they were consistent with the Second Amendment. So that's a very wide concept of what reasonable gun control is, and a very narrow concept of what the constitutional right to keep and bear arms is.
Okay. So Adam, then are we approaching some territory where you and Jacob disagree about what the Second Amendment means?
Well, so far we haven't entered any area of disagreement. I think we both are in agreement that the real question comes in defining how much gun control is permissible, how broadly the right is construed. That's really where the rubber hits the road in constitutional interpretation and in constitutional litigation. It's not just identifying the nature of the right, it's separating out which laws are constitutional and which laws are unconstitutional. And I imagine where we divide that line, where we put that line, might separate Jacob and I on some issues. But I think that's really where the mainstream debate is today. I think that Heller has put to rest the question of whether the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to have guns for personal protection. We don't see a lot of argument these days. It's not to say there aren't people who believe that that's the wrong interpretation of the Second Amendment. There certainly are. But that's not really a mainstream issue. And the truth of the matter is no one's really talking about eliminating civilians' access to firearms. There is efforts to think about universal background checks, seeing to it that people who are not eligible to have access to firearms, the mentally ill and people with criminal convictions, for instance, don't have easy access through gun shows or classified ads or other kinds of private sales. With regards to assault weapons, that's where the debate is there a constitutional right to have an assault weapon? And if there is a constitutional right, is it violated by the restrictions proposed by the Obama administration? And also the third proposal, high-capacity magazines, whether we can ban the manufacture and sale of these new new high-capacity magazines.
Okay, so you've listed three issues, background checks and related things, an assault weapons ban, and a magazine limitation. I would think that the latter two are, from a constitutional point of view, essentially the same question, right? In other words, can you limit the type of firearm that people use? Is that right?
Well, actually, I would say that there's probably a stronger argument for the magazine limit in the sense that it is a true functional difference. How much it matters in practice is another issue, but it is a true functional difference. If you can fire 10 rounds without reloading versus 15 or 20 or 30, that's a true functional difference. I think Adam and I agree, though, that assault weapon bans don't really deal with functional differences, at least not differences that are important in the context of mass shootings or ordinary kinds of gun crime. Basically, they're identifying weapons based on these cosmetic features that look scary, mm-hmm. that make the weapons look like machine guns that soldiers carry, but they function the same as any other automatic gun that can accept a detachable magazine. Just yesterday I was looking this up to see, was a gun that I have an assault weapon under Feinstein's latest bill? And it's tricky because it's actually listed as one of the exempted guns in her appendix. It has over 5,000 exempted guns, but it has a barrel shroud on it, which is mm-hmm. one of the forbidden characteristics. So had it not been listed specifically in this appendix, it would have been banned under this law. Why? You know, why is a barrel shroud acceptable mm-hmm. on this particular model but not on others that are functionally identical? It makes no sense to me. So I think that, on the one hand, it restricts the right to bear arms less precisely because there is a very little functional difference. There are equally effective substitutes. But then again, the justification for it is so weak that I think that even if you had a relatively low level of scrutiny for gun control, it would fail the test. Even if it's intermediate scrutiny, I would argue even if it's rational, they had a rational basis test, if that meant anything, which maybe in practice it doesn't, but there really is no rational basis for a ban on assault weapons.
Okay, so Adam,
that's harder to justify.
So Adam, first of all, do you agree on the assault weapon question, or do you think they should be subject to banning?
I think that as a matter of policy, banning assault weapons is not a particularly good idea. It's not likely to be effective. These firearms are not often used in criminal activity. Not to say they're never used, but they're not frequently used in criminal activity. The differentiation between what is a so-called assault weapon and that which is not an assault weapon does depend mostly on cosmetic characteristics mm-hmm. of the firearm. And last I checked, things like a pistol grip or having a bayonet lug are not the kinds of things that we really need to worry about with regards to America's gun dilemma. So I agree with Jacob that As a matter of policy, there's really not going to be any significant gains from banning assault weapons. My own personal preference, as expressed to Biden's team, was not to include an assault weapons ban in the list of proposals. However, I think that the courts are unlikely to strike down an assault weapons ban. I think that there is a constitutional argument to be made that the assault weapons ban violates the Second Amendment. I, however, think it's a close call, and it's unlikely that the courts would rule against it. As evidence of that, the D.C. Circuit Court, in an opinion by Douglas Ginsburg, I have a good friend named David Ginsburg, he came to mind quickly, but Doug Ginsburg, who was himself nominated to the United States Supreme Court, is known as a conservative, libertarian-leaning judge, and another conservative, Republican-appointed judge, sided in favor of Washington, D.C.'s ban on assault weapons, saying that while these weapons are in common use and thus likely protected, at least somewhat, some measure, by the Second Amendment, that restricting access to these guns really doesn't limit anybody's ability to defend themselves. Okay. As Jacob said, there's a lot of easy substitutes.
Okay, so where you and Jacob clearly disagree is on the magazine size limitation. Now, Jacob, it seems the default argument against your position would be the Constitution says that there's a right to bear arms. It doesn't say there's a right to bear arms with X number of bullets or anything else. So on what grounds do you argue that limitations of that sort would be unconstitutional?
Well, the test that the Supreme Court suggested in Heller, where they overturned the District of Columbia's gun ban, was that the Second Amendment protects the right to have weapons that are in common use for lawful purposes. Guns that have magazines with more than 10 rounds certainly are in common use for lawful purposes. They are shipped standard with many categories of very popular guns, both rifles and handguns, that come with more than 10 rounds, 30 rounds for a lot of the sporting rifles, 15 or 17 or 19 rounds for some of the most popular handguns. So you really can't say that these are not in common use for lawful purposes. They are.
Isn't there something circular about defining it as what's in common use for lawful purposes? I mean, if they were illegal, they wouldn't be in common use.
Yeah, so that's actually a good point, and it goes to the next sort of standard that I was going to raise, which overlaps to some extent, which is machine guns are not now in common use for lawful purposes. But that, Adam actually makes
it. But that's because they're illegal, right?
Yeah, so right. That is largely due to the fact that they're so severely restricted under the law. So in that sense, it is circular. They imposed the ban. As a result of the ban, they're not in common use anymore. So then you could say they're not in common use. But they are in common use by soldiers. And that was another aspect of this test is what is the sort of weapon that would be used in a militia, that would be used in defense against invaders or insurrection or what have you, and it would be what are the guns that are commonly carried by your average soldier. Historically, civilians have had access to those guns, and it's relatively recent that the government has decided, no, you can't have those guns even though they're commonly carried by soldiers.
Okay, so Adam, what's your reply to the argument that the test should be what's in use by soldiers?
Well, the Supreme Court did, as Jacob said, say that the arms that are protected by the Second Amendment are those that are in common use for lawful purposes, and that distinguishes machine guns, although, again, that's perhaps a function of the regulations in place, but also shoulder-launched missiles and hand grenades. You often hear people say, well, if you have a right to bear arms, that means you have a right to have a tank. It's not a firearm that's in common use.
It's also hard to bear a tank.
Very hard to bear a tank. But you could keep.
I find
them
unbearable myself.
Right. You could keep a tank, and there are two different rights: a right to keep and a right to bear.
Yeah.
So they are, and I think both assault weapons and I think high capacity magazines are likely to be determined to be in common use. There are millions of these things out there. I think there's two points I would make with regards to the constitutional question on high capacity magazines. One. Like the court does say in Heller that those firearms are that firearms that are in common use for lawful purposes are protected. The court also said, however, that the core purpose of the Second Amendment is self-defense. And if that's the core purpose of the Second Amendment, then it seems to me at least possible that the court's going to say, Well, a firearm may be in common use, but if it's not in common use for one of the core purposes of the Second Amendment, such as self-defense, then it's not necessarily protected. So that would be one point about in common use. It might be only in common use for self-defense when push comes to shove, since that's the purpose of the Second Amendment, according to the Supreme Court. A second possibility is even if it's protected by the Second Amendment, even if it is in common use and for lawful purposes, and that's the appropriate standard. The lower courts, like the D.C. Circuit Court, upheld a ban on high-capacity magazines because they said, the judges said, again, it's not a substantial limitation on anyone's right of self-defense. In fact, the vast majority of times a gun is used for defensive purposes, the gun's never even fired. Even and in the vast majority of instances where the gun is fired, people fire no more than two rounds of ammunition. The number of times that someone in self-defense needs to shoot more than 10 rounds of ammunition is extremely small, and I think it's unlikely that the courts are going to say that that restriction is a substantial limitation on self-defense.
I would suggest that that observation cuts both ways, because if it's true that the number of rounds that a magazine can hold does not make an important difference in practice in the vast majority of cases, what's the point of limiting it? You know, how do we think that's going to affect criminals? It was very telling that in New York State, where they very hurriedly passed within the first day or two of the legislative session this new package of gun controls, including a new limit on magazine size. They reduced it from 10 to 7. Afterward, suddenly the police and the retired cops realized that the legislature had forgotten to exempt them, and they were very upset about this. They said, we need those extra rounds. You're leaving us vulnerable. You're endangering people's lives. And furthermore, no criminal is going to pay attention to this limit anyway. It's absurd. This is what the cops are saying. It's absurd to think this is going to affect crime at all, and yet they support it as long as they have an exemption for themselves. So I would argue that if, in fact, we think this has a self-defense value, albeit in a you know very limited number of cases, a small percentage of cases, the extra rounds do matter, whether you have multiple assailants or you have somebody wearing body armor, or in the heat of the moment, not all of your rounds find the target, which is quite, you know, possible and likely that that would happen. For whatever reason, you know, there are scenarios which are not hypothetical involving riots and following disasters where you have mobs of people that are going around, you know, looting and attacking people. And so in that kind of scenario, you might want to have what a so-called large capacity magazine. If there are situations like that where there is value to having the extra rounds, then you are limiting people's ability to defend themselves. If there is not value to the extra rounds, the police should not be complaining, and they should accept the same limits that everybody else has to follow.
Adam?
I think there are two potential responses to that. I think one potential response is that what we may find is if we can limit the size of magazine capacity and that becomes an effective restriction on access to high-capacity magazines over time, then the argument is that that might help interrupt mass shooters. So, for instance, we know that in Arizona, the shooter, Jared Lochner, who went after Representative Gabrielle Giffords, was tackled when his magazine jammed and he had to replace the magazine. They gave people just a moment of time. It's not to say that in all instances that moment of time is enough to interfere with a mass shooter. We know that Adam Lanza reloaded his firearm, I think, four times over the course of his shooting. So it's not a perfect solution. But I think we need to realize that with regards to gun control, no law is going to be perfect. There are 300 million guns, it's estimated, in America today. As long as those 300 million guns are out there, and I think they're out there to stay, it's going to be very difficult to adopt laws that restrict access to particular kinds of weapons that are already very commonplace, or particular devices like a high-capacity magazine that is also out there. There's a lot of them already out there. So I think what we're going to see in Congress is an increasing focus as the days go on universal background checks. I think that's an area where most people think we can make the biggest impact. Again, it's not going to completely change the world, but do something to reduce the daily death toll from guns.
I would observe that Adam is right. There are some cases where gunmen have been overpowered when they're in the middle of changing magazines. It only takes a second or two to do that, but you can imagine that there are scenarios like that. In fact, there have been at least Well, there are three, basically, that people cite over and over again, which is telling because it's three out of every mass shooting that's ever happened in the United States where it's been documented to have happened. And all the others, it wasn't really an issue. He wasn't stopped. Certainly in this latest massacre, the size of the magazine was not an issue. Certainly in the biggest school massacre ever at Virginia Tech, it was not an issue. He had many, many magazines. He changed them many, many times. And by the way, he did not use assault weapons. He used ordinary handguns. So I think you can say in some cases having a smaller capacity magazine might make a difference. You also have some cases where having the larger capacity magazine is going to make a difference in terms of defending against an attacker. So you, just in terms of costs and benefits, you have to weigh those two effects against each other. And as Adam points out, this is really kind of magical thinking anyway, because there's so many millions of these so-called large capacity magazines in circulation that this is not going to have any impact at all on criminals who are, assuming they are determined to get the larger magazines, they're not going to have a problem getting them. Let me illustrate how absurd this kind of magical thinking is. In New York, the official expectation is that if you have a pre-existing 10-round magazine, that you only put 7 rounds in it. That's what the law of New York is now. So imagine a criminal who gets his hands, well, he's not supposed to be armed anyway, assuming he has a felony record. So he's already broken the law by getting the gun. He's planning to break the law because he's a criminal. That's what criminals do. So he's not deterred by the fact that the legislature says he shouldn't have a 10-round magazine. He obtains a 10-round magazine, and now the legislature expects him to pause while loading up the magazine. And when he gets to 7, he's going to stop because he knows that Governor Cuomo doesn't want him to have more than 7 rounds. That is the expectation. That's the notion. You know, that's the only scenario which is this is possibly going to have an impact on crime, and it's completely absurd. And that's sort of the nature of gun control legislation these days, is people pass these things in a hurry because it makes them feel better, but it has no real impact on crime.
I was going to say that, you know, in New York, you also can only fill up your big gulp to a certain amount, too. So you got to be careful. People won't fill up those extra 2 ounces, I'm sure.
You can go back for refills.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I do think that if there's a possibility of having an impact from banning the manufacture and sale of these high-capacity magazines, it will come over time as we raise the price for these items. By creating an artificial scarcity, if you will, for high-capacity magazines, you will make them much more expensive over time.
So you mean you raise the price for used ones if you ban the sale of new ones?
Yeah, exactly.
And you can even have buyback programs and so on.
People won't be able to sell them legally. You can only sell them illegally. But if you dry up the supply, you are putting artificial limits on the supply. Normal economic thinking should tell us that over time that's going to raise the price. If you can raise the price significantly, then criminals who often try to buy cheap guns and generally probably don't feel that they need more than 10 rounds of ammunition to commit their crimes. Most criminals who have guns say that they hope never to shoot them, much less shoot them more than 10 times. Then perhaps over time you can have an impact by making them harder to come by for criminals. Again, we should be realistic about how long that would take to have that effect and exactly how significant that effect will be in debating this policy. But I think we're at least talking about the right questions.
And well, at this point, I should mention 3D printing.
Oh, please.
because somebody has already produced. Now, gun is much harder. Gun is harder to produce entirely.
Yes, they're not made of plastic for one.
Magazines thing. You can do, and they can be used repeatedly without breaking. And that's already been developed. It's something that's going to become more and more available and cheaper. So really, even leaving aside the fact that there are many millions of these magazines in circulation, people can quite easily make their own. In the near future, they'll be able to do that, assuming they can't get them on the black market.
So, Jacob, where do you draw the line? If you think, I guess, an infinite number of bullets in a magazine is okay, unless you draw the line at 100 or somewhere, what is your line on automatic weapons, shoulder-fired missiles? What can the government legitimately ban?
Well, as I suggested before, I think there is a serious constitutional question about the machine gun ban if we take the line, as the Supreme Court has in Miller, for example, as well as Heller, that we're talking about the kinds of weapons that a militia would have, or that soldiers would commonly be issued. I think, rocket launchers are more debatable because not every soldier has those. They're not you know, given out as a standard sidearm.
But how does an automatic weapon pass the in common use and legal test?
It's not. No, you're right. It's not in common use now, but that's because of the restriction. So that's
Right. But if you're going to accept, I mean, either the circularity, you know, either you accept the circularity of the law or you don't. You can't have it both ways, right?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, you have to kind of settle on which standard. But if you have this long-standing rule that has made a weapon artificially scarce, it sort of seems unreasonable to cite that scarcity as a rationale for continuing the ban. I mean, that's
well,
circular reasoning.
Right, but I mean, my point is that if by the same token, the lack of a limitation, you know, the fact that people have high-capacity magazines is a function of the fact that this arguably deficient law has been in effect, that you change the law and blah, blah, blah. I'm just saying the circularity argument, it seems to me, cuts both ways in principle.
Yes, but I mean, right now, for sure, what they call high-capacity magazines, which really are not high-capacity because they're not unusually large, right? They're very common. Those are right now in common use for lawful purposes, no question. So you have to justify banning them even though they're in common use for lawful purposes.
Even there you draw the line somewhere, right? Because 100-round magazines, they exist but are not in common use.
Well, there's a reason for that. They don't work very well. I mean, the guy in Colorado, Aurora, he actually had this magazine that held 100 rounds. It jammed almost immediately. And
banning those is okay because they're not in common use?
No, I'm not saying it is okay. I'm just saying they're not in common use because they don't work very well.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think that really this fear of magazine capacity is greatly exaggerated. If you look at what happened in Connecticut, they say, oh, he fired, you know, 150 rounds, which sounds like a lot, but it was over a period of 20 minutes. So that rate of fire, he could have done the same thing with a bolt action rifle, that rate of fire. He did not, you know, we already mentioned he switched magazines over and over again. So that was not an issue. So supposedly that's the event that justifies all this new attention to gun control. And yet all of these proposals have little or nothing to do with that event.
I think that's right, that none of these really have a lot to do with that event. And I actually think that's a compliment, not a criticism. I don't think we should be driven by high-profile, singular incidents in devising policy. We need to look at at guns the way we look at other problems in society, look at them systematically, not look at them as particular anecdotes. I don't think we should be trying to disarm Adam Lanza. He's done his damage. He won't be doing any more. We should be doing everything we can to reduce the daily death toll from guns. It's mass shootings, but it's also just ordinary criminal use of guns. And I think there's very little we can do to prevent mass shootings. Norway has very significant and strict gun control laws. They had the worst mass shooting in human history just within the last 2 years. So nothing is going to stop the mass shooter who really wants to kill a lot of people and is deranged enough to do it. What we can do, though, what we should do, are things like close the private sale loophole, require universal background checks, that might actually stop people from, as we know happens here in California, going to Arizona, going to a gun show where they take their fake ID, nothing's ever checked, and they can buy as many guns as they want and then bring them right back to California. We have ATF surveillance video showing of known gang members doing this. It makes sense. If you're a gang member and you want to have easy access to firearms, you go to a marketplace where you're going to have a lot of options.
Now, do you two disagree on the constitutionality of background checks, let alone leave aside the efficacy for now? Jacob, do you disagree with Adam on the constitutionality?
The constitutionality, I think, is a debatable question. As a matter of policy and a matter of libertarian philosophy, I object to them. And largely because the categories of excluded owners are so indiscriminate. Look at the people who are supposedly forbidden from buying or owning guns under federal law. They include all felons, all people with felony records, whether or not it was a violent felony, whether or not it actually involved a victim, right? So you have nonviolent drug offenders who, because they grew marijuana, now can never have the right to keep and bear arms. They never have a right to armed self-defense again. That makes no sense to me. You have an even wider category of unlawful users of controlled substances, right? So how many people have smoked pot in the last year? How many people have used Xanax or Vicodin that they got from a relative? Those are unlawful uses of controlled substances. 40 million or so, according to survey data. The true number is probably substantially larger. All of those people are supposedly barred from buying guns under federal law. So if you actually got serious, as everybody keeps insisting, including the NRA, by the way, if you actually got serious about enforcing current law and you could get the data that would identify all of those unlawful users, I think the result would actually be worse, not better. We want bad enforcement of bad laws. This is a bad law, and it should not be enforced better.
Adam, how do you feel about it? Let's take...
I'll address the constitutional questions and then the policy questions. Okay. So the constitutional question, I think, is crystal clear here, actually. I think that the Supreme Court made clear in the Heller case that the decision was not intended to call into doubt prohibitions on felons or the mentally ill from having firearms. We often hear people comparing the Second Amendment to the First Amendment. We should treat the Second Amendment just like the First Amendment. The big difference between the Second Amendment and the First Amendment is that the First Amendment has no eligibility criteria. Everyone has the freedom of speech. But we know from the Supreme Court's decision and the history and tradition of the right to bear arms violent felons, for instance, can be lawfully excluded from possessing firearms. We know that minors and the mentally ill can be excluded from possessing firearms. The right to bear arms is more like the right to vote. Where you can have things like prophylactic rules to ensure that only those people who are eligible to exercise that right can indeed and do exercise that right. I think there's almost no chance that the Supreme Court would strike down a universal background check. I think the gun debate has been changed a little bit by this Sandy Hook shooting. We're seeing not only evidence of that in Capitol Hill, where there's been really no desire to touch gun control for about 20 years. All of a sudden we are talking about it. It seems hard for me to believe that the Supreme Court wouldn't be at least somewhat affected by that large mood change in the court, in the country. With regards to policy, I guess Jacob and I would agree probably that some of these rules can be rethought. We shouldn't limit necessarily, in my view, people who are nonviolent felons from possessing firearms. Martha Stewart has a federal felony from her obstruction of justice with regards to her insider trading case. While I'm perfectly happy
to keep her unarmed.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't mind her with a gun. A hot glue gun worries me, maybe, more than a real firearm. But for instance, there are people who are charged with perjury. I'm not sure why we're banning them from having guns for the rest of their lives. But that said, there's no reason why we should have laws that say felons shouldn't be able to buy guns and then do what we used to have, which was basically have no rules in place whatsoever to stop felons from actually buying guns. So they would go to a store and they would lie and buy and say, no, I'm not a felon. Sell me the gun. And the gun stores would sell it to them. Having this national instant background check system where people just have to enter a name or number into this system is really, it's not a significant burden on the law-abiding, responsible citizen. And I think in terms of policy, it's important to close those gaps in federal law that allow easy access to the purchase of guns by felons and the mentally ill.
So, Jacob, do you agree, first of all, that as a practical matter, this would be found constitutional by the courts?
Yes.
And then secondly, what do you think of that finding? I mean, in other words, does it make sense that you could apply this right, the Second Amendment right, with a kind of discernment that you don't apply the First Amendment with?
I don't think it's right that people, by virtue of having committed something that Congress deems to be a felony, forever lose their Second Amendment rights. I don't think that should be the case. For that matter, they shouldn't lose their voting rights either. I mean, Adam mentioned voting rights. I think it's bad policy. I don't understand why we approach. I mean, I get it. Guns kill people in the hands of people who are intent on killing people. So they're different in that sense from speech. But when it comes to the First Amendment, there are regulations that are acceptable and there are rules for those. And I don't want to get bogged down in the terminology, but the gist of it is that you need a good reason. You need a good reason to restrict freedom of speech, right?
Cases.
And we can argue over what a good reason is or not, but something like an assault weapon ban, to me, there is no good reason for that. So it doesn't seem like that should pass the test. And I don't think a lot of these exclusions have good reason. Now, a violent felon, an armed robber, let's say. Mm-hmm. Okay, I see the logic to that. This guy has used guns to commit crimes in the past. We don't want him to have guns in the future. That makes sense to me. But a lot of these other categories, another one, by the way, is somebody who is here unlawfully, right? So if you are an illegal construction worker or an illegal farm worker, Your need for self-defense is not any less than that of the average person. It's probably greater, and your propensity to go on a shooting rampage is not any higher than the average person.
Okay.
Why can't they defend themselves? It doesn't make sense to me.
So you are willing to see both the First and Second Amendment applied with discernment. You just think that a lot of the proposed restrictions in the case of the Second Amendment are not discerning in the sense that the criteria are not relevant.
There's very little scrutiny being applied to the rationales for these restrictions, at least so far. The other thing I would point out is that if you have so-called universal background checks, meaning that for every transfer, I think President Obama said there would be an exception for members of the family, right? So if a father wants to pass a hunting rifle to his son, he doesn't have to run a background check on his son. But otherwise, every transfer would be subject to a background check. Well, how do you enforce that? One answer is you don't enforce it, which is the most likely possibility. They just officially say this is what's required, but nobody really enforces it. But if you're going to actually seriously enforce it, well, now you have to know where all the guns are and when they change hands. Well, how do you do that? You have to have national gun registration and a national database of all guns. That's the only way to do it. And that raises other problems, which I can get into. There is a reason why historically defenders of the Second Amendment have been leery of gun registration.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we're running out of time, and Adam, I know in particular, has to leave within exactly 3 minutes. So, Adam, let me toss a quick question at you, and you can control how long the answer is. It's just this occurred to me. You said that that Heller, the key Supreme Court ruling, found that the fundamental purpose of the Second Amendment is self-defense. I take that to mean self-defense in an individual sense, like somebody coming into my house. And if that's correct, I mean, if that's what they meant, I just cannot fathom why somebody wanting to write it, who is writing an amendment for that purpose, would begin it with a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. Am I misunderstanding what you said or what?
Well, no, I think you're not misunderstanding me. I think you're showing perhaps that maybe the originalism that was said to be triumphant in the Heller case wasn't nearly as triumphant as many people thought. In fact, if you look at the history of the right to bear arms, what we see is that in the founding period, most of the argument was about militias and about protecting states from tyranny, from federal tyranny or from tyranny of others, being able to have a militia that was armed, even though the citizens' militia was broadly defined to include all males between the ages of 18 and 45, which at the time was the vast majority of people who were recognized as citizens in the United States at the time.
Okay.
But what happens, what we see in the 1820s and 1830s, as the militias become less effective as a fighting force, and we realize after the War of 1812 that we need a standing army, you see the right to bear arms subtly shift in terms of its core purpose, and the focus becomes personal protection in a time of rising crime rates. And it's that tradition, I think, that's mostly reflected in the Heller decision.
Okay, so now we only have time for Jacob to say either Adam, you're right, or Adam, you're wrong.
I think that this all boils down to self-defense. It's defense against tyranny. It's defense against invaders. It's defense against criminals. These are all kinds of self-defense. So I don't see it as being contradictory to say it's about militia versus self-defense. These are all kinds of self-defense.
Okay, that will be the last word. Thank you both for inaugurating this possibly new blogging head genre of moderated discussion. I apologize to you two for the technical difficulties that preceded the recording, and I apologize to the entire universe for the technical difficulties that afflicted the opening portion when I failed to highlight the people who are actually speaking for a while. But it'll all get better. And so thanks to both of you, Adam Winkler and Jacob Sullum.
Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
We'll see what happens policy-wise.